Civic.
Oh, okay, you
and, are. Yeah, I've been there now for 15 years.
Okay.
So when Vic, and it was a total mystery to us why he did it, when he decided he was going to give his archives to Pacific.
I know. I always wonder. I went back and thought, what? Yeah, what's the relationship? It's wonderful, but what's the relationship?
It took me a year and a half into this after he had died to figure it out.
What is it?
It is because when he was elected in 1958, it was a multiple member district.
Yeah.
Pacific was his university until 1972 in his district.
That's what I was wondering, whether he had represented it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing was, he looked at U of O that he always considered himself an alumni of, and he knew that they would just bury it.
Well, we know that. So. My husband's dad was in Congress, and he sent, Bob sent stuff to the U of O years ago, and then some stuff to the Historical Society, and I know all of it is sitting in boxes in both places because they don't have the capacity.
Exactly.
And this Women's Center at Portland State's getting all of this records from women legislators with whom I've been involved a lot. I don't know. I don't know how they can curate this stuff.
No, I don't either. And then there's the stuff that people want to give. So I had a really funny conversation with Barbara Roberts.
Uh-huh.
Once again, after Vic had died, I encountered it with him. People will not take all of her plaques and awards.
No,
and,
they won't. And, nobody wants
and
them.
We didn't. And our archivist didn't know that, and so we have a bunch of
Barbara Roberts.
Vic stuff, all those plaques and things. And then I went to the Washington County Historical Society, which doesn't have much except it has a whole bunch of his plaques. And I actually got two bits of useful information just reading the plaques.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, isn't
so that was good, but it's like, yeah, you're right. The Thorns, when I interviewed them, had the same problem.
Oh, I know. Well, so, we've sort of hitched most of my father-in-law's. You know, we've saved the ones that we thought represented significant legislative contributions or a story that we knew.
Yeah.
But we don't have much anymore.
Yeah. From his time as Speaker, did that go?
I don't have almost anything from that.
It's so tough. That's why I really like to have a scan of your letter from Vic.
Mm-hmm.
He, for a while, was really good. His first several terms, he kept a scrapbook, or Dolores kept a scrapbook or something.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful?
And so, like, from his first two terms, I've got all the notes that they passed back and forth. So when Monty Montgomery becomes a tremendous scumball and goes to prison for, you know, not very long, 30 days.
It was horrible.
But I've got him writing to Vic in 1959 just being horrible about women.
Oh,
and, you know, said, well, keep an eye on this name because it's going to come back. And then all of a sudden it stops, and it's partly because he begins to move into more leadership positions and things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But the legislative stuff is really tough to find.
What do we have from Bob's stuff? Angus's elder sister has done a lot of family archives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's much at all from that. Probably some campaign materials.
Yeah. Which
but what was it? What was a campaign in 1958 in Medford? You know, not much.
There is some valuable campaign stuff Vic had simply because no one understands the multiple member district. He ran as a slate.
Right. Oh.
So John Mosser, who's the first head of
DEQ,
and Bobby Jones, federal judge,
mm-hmm.
they were the slate in 1962. And so I've got their campaign stuff.
That's fun.
Yeah. So I showed it to Bobby at one of the old-timers. He goes, oh, yeah. Oh, and he started telling me more stories.
Isn't he great?
He's amazing. I keep reading he's doing real trials. This was before Robert Jones, you know, one of the Malheur people. It's like, you're kidding. But okay, good.
That's so much fun. Now, the other thing I want, and I really just thought about maybe having just a small group of people over and asking Packwood to come
mm-hmm.
and dissect the tax bill. and talk about
what
the alternatives could have been.
Yeah.
If simplification were your goal,
right?
Where would you begin, and what would be the financial consequences?
Exactly.
And how would he have approached it? And you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Their whole thing was revenue neutral, and this avowedly is not.
And
it makes all the difference in the world.
Anyway, I just would love to hear. I mean, speaking of people that are still nailing I think Bob is still just pretty much on it.
Yeah, he is. There's some things, you know, and he's Bob, so some things where he's gone, and I see this with a lot of the people that age.
Mm-hmm.
They have a story in their head, and they just tell it word for word every single time.
Oh, I know it. I've seen it. You almost go, no, I've heard it.
Yeah.
Enough. But this won't happen to us.
Oh, God, no.
And I'm inching closer and closer to that. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
So let's back up. So do you teach then? You're teaching
Side? Yeah, I'm teaching.
State local, or what are you teaching?
I teach, I'm half international and half American.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually knew Vic beginning in 2001, because that's when I left the University of Portland. And so my good buddy from there, Vern Duncan, I said, Vern, you know, I'm an internationalist.
Mm-hmm.
Portland's supposed to be an international town, and what I discovered is Portland's not an international town in any way, shape, or form.
No. Oh, my God.
Incredible.
No.
It's like, that's it? You guys are nuts.
Well, I was on the World Affairs Council board. I did my master's in international economics.
Yeah.
And
it's hilarious.
I came home looking for work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But okay, so Vern said, you need to go talk to Vic Etienne.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called Vic, and, you know, as everybody who's dealt with Vic finds out, he says, come on down.
Yeah.
And so I had a great talk with him.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, he said, if I were the governor, you'd be running my economic development.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's great. And I thought, oh, geez, Kulikowski's just in. I wonder if he could put in a word, not knowing really any of the history there. When he was governor, when Vic was governor, was when I didn't live in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I didn't know this. But then just, you know, running into him and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when he approached the archives, the archivist and the head of the library went to his office.
Uh-huh.
Usually when an archive happens, you pile everything in boxes, a truck pulls up, and you ship it away.
Yes.
Vic, no, here's a box, and I'll tell you stories. You take that box and then come back later, and I'll give you another box and tell you stories. And so the librarian and the archivist, after the first time, said, we'd like to bring Jim Moore along. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, Jim would be great.
Yeah.
Because he's also, one reason he chose me to do this is because he sees my media stuff and things.
Yes,
You call it like you see it, that's what I want. And so it just began this wonderful series of talks and throwing out political science-y things and seeing where he went with them. And, and there you go.
Yeah.
And then after his... In 2013, October, we had the opening of the archive.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I went to that.
Yeah.
I was there. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the top 3 days in his life. It was his wedding and his first gubernatorial election.
And that.
He just was stunned.
Mm.
And then shortly after that, kind of to go decompress from it at his house, he asked me to write the book. So.
Isn't that? Well, that's wonderful, and these things we should be doing. It was never done earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was started and then it died.
You know, but you didn't have Earl Snell or, you know what I mean?
I know.
I don't know these guys at all because I didn't come to Oregon except for college.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my history begins there.
Yeah. But yeah, Earl Snell.
I mean, but all of these people, who knows squat about them?
Yeah, nobody knows anything about them. And doing, one of the things I did for this is I put together every single gubernatorial election.
Uh-huh.
The results, how close it was, and then ranked them all.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Snell is clearly the most amazing politician the state has ever seen.
Oh, really?
He won statewide offices by like 85% to 15%.
You're kidding.
For governor. And then he did it again. And nobody knows anything about him.
No. No. And well, of course, this is a Capital Foundation project. If we could ever get the Capital Foundation, we're doing really well, but mm-hmm. we really need we need a larger staff. I mean, we're working our way towards it, but I want to go out and find portraits of every governor so that they're all in the Capitol building and that there is a story about them so that they...
Yeah, they're not just a
not just face. Not just a glowering old white guy staring at you. Yeah. But that you get a story about the person or about one of his major contributions.
Right.
What a blast. I mean, hire me to have a ball.
Yeah. But, exactly. And somebody did that in the 1950s, so it goes up to...
Does know, it?
Basically, it stops just before Hatfield.
Huh. And where is this?
It's a funny little book.
I've
there.
Never seen it.
Yeah, it's a funny
I've seen
book.
A lot.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this.
Yeah. Well, it's like I found, I think, the only biography of Oswald West. Denny Miles is really ticked off because he said, I have every one of them. It's like, oh, I was reading the Oz West biography. I don't have that one. It's like, well,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Very interesting. Okay.
Okay.
So I don't even know how much... background, you know, you kind of have to give me some.
Right. Well, what I'd like to do, because you interned with Vic,
mm-hmm.
I'd like you to just talk to me about becoming his intern and what did you do and what did you see a bit in that session.
Okay. We'll do that. And then you wanted to talk about the Crazy McCall.
Yeah,
night.
Crazy McCall stuff. So we'll get into how I don't know when you started working with him, but, you know, he was basically on everybody's list to run for that office a year and a half before he finally said he was in. So, you know, anything on that, and then at the end as well.
I mean, went Vic to run for governor, is that what you're saying?
No, people were talking about Tom McCall running for governor again in 1976.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
Because we'll talk about that.
You know, the Vic side, if you know anything on the Vic side of him getting in,
I don't.
Go for it, but I got tons on that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And the answer is, I don't.
Yeah, exactly.
I know nothing, you know, I was a kid. Anyway, okay, so, all of this is we've been recording on this too bad. All right, so as an intern, I was a sophomore at Willamette, political science major, and one of the reasons I went to Willamette was that I could work across the street.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted that experience. So basically, our professor, a guy named Ted Shea, assigned us. And he found out who was looking for, who would take an intern, and asked whether we wanted to work for a Republican or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, of course, I was going to work for a Republican. Life has changed since then, believe me. So Vic, I just got randomly assigned this guy from Washington County, who I didn't know, obviously. I didn't know anybody. This was in an era when there were no offices, and we sat on the floor. He and his secretary sat on the floor, and this was my opportunity to simply learn the process. And he was very careful about telling me about the process. He was also the minority leader, which didn't mean a lot.
Right.
Because there were maybe six of them.
Yeah.
And so they met in a little closet, practically. Mm-hmm. And Vic did have a little extra office for that, but not enough to turn around in. What happened, I loved it, so I was over there more than I needed to be. Because
the disadvantage of being across the street.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
But in the middle of the session, his secretary, whose name you probably have and whose name is escaping me, her son died suddenly and tragically.
Mm-hmm.
And he was absent administrative staff.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, these are the days all you had was one person.
Right.
So he asked if I would do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was so flattered and so thrilled and slightly overwhelmed at what this meant. What it really meant, of course, is filing the bills, because again, we were getting the bills in printed form, and we kept folders of them. And then with every bill that was debated on the floor, the secretaries, and that's really what people were then, the secretaries found that bill, opened it, made sure that they'd had the latest amended version, and so that their member was reading the bill as it was being debated. That was a pretty critical thing to do. The other thing was, of course, to answer constituent mail, of which there wasn't an overwhelming amount in those days, in part because everybody went home at night. They saw their friends, they went to the Rotary Club, and they were only in session for preferably 4 months, often five. So I would say the work was not overwhelming at all, and, and it was doable, and he was such a calm, measured presence that probably there were political crises that I was too naive to recognize, and he went right on through at this steady pace. One would never have known that there was a crisis, and so in a sense, that modeled for me. Now, was I conscious that that modeled for me? I don't know. But by contrast, some years, say 6-7 years later, when I was working for McCall, when McCall was governor, believe me.
It's a very different thing.
Polar opposites.
Yeah.
And I was in a state of shock. And in the meantime, I had also worked for Mark Hatfield, also a very steady, deliberate, even, rational guy. And that was the way things went. So all of this were, you know, growth experiences. At the end of as the session is coming to an end, this is 1967, school was out. School gets out in May. And this session had the temerity to run long. And before I left to go home for the summer, Vic and Dolores and Suzanne, they took me on a boat trip on the Willamette. It was, and I have a picture of that. It's darling. On a, you know, a Saturday, please come to Portland. We'll take you. I mean, it makes me, it grips me that, you know, how dear and thoughtful he was in a way he never had to be. And then the session, I don't know when the session ended. We'll have to look at that letter. But early June, maybe. And so I got a letter, and he was handwritten out of the blue, frankly. I had no expectation that I would have any contact with him again, and explaining, noting that the session had gone way too long. It was not acceptable. And that, or implying that, we'll have to see exactly what it says. And then talking about a couple of pieces of legislation that he had lateraled to me to, you know, pay particular attention to, and so this is what happened to it. It was the most, gosh, it was just such an intimate and thoughtful thing to do, and I recognize, as you look back, how unusual that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you go to committees? What was he like on committees? Same kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He knew where his votes were. He always knew where his votes were. And so he walked in prepared, and he could tell me, you know, we're going to be working on this, whatever this, you know, Bill X. But we've got the votes to get it out, or we're not going to, you know, this isn't going to pass. Because of these reasons. So it was, again, it was gentlemanly. All I can say is always gentlemanly. I never heard a disparaging is a word. They never heard a disparaging word. I never heard anything deeply, hostily critical about other members mm-hmm. or about various lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear a lot more of that now,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the corridors and in informal right. discussions with other lobbyists and with members. I never heard, you know, geez, that guy's an idiot, you know, mm-hmm. which you mm-hmm. hear a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and that interests me, and certainly not ever a derogatory word about members of his caucus.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Those guys he worked with, and I wish I could name them all. You know who these people yeah. are at this point from your research.
Yeah.
I didn't get to know them.
Yeah, yeah. And people generally didn't unless they ended up being, like, working in the caucus office.
Uh-huh.
And then you kind of know. And
yeah.
as you said, by the 70s, the caucus is 6 people or 7 people. It's easy to know who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Or easy to know that Bob Smith never came to any of the meetings. Because he wanted to be the leader, and they didn't want him, and so he didn't go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At one point, Tony Meeker dragged him to the door and said, "Look, Bob's at one of our meetings," and then Bob just left.
See, so when was Meeker there?
Meeker is, I think, early 70s is when he first showed up.
Early 70s, okay.
Yeah.
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 Okay. So he wasn't there in 67. I was trying to remember the R's who were there, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, and then in 69, I worked in the House side, again, for another Republican named
right.
Bob Davis.
Right.
And
that's when they were in the majority still?
Yeah, Bob was Speaker Pro Tem.
Yeah.
And that was also fascinating because just as in Washington, the culture of the Senate and the House are
right.
very different.
Yeah.
And I worked in both the Senate and the House in D.C. and then here, and I thought, this, you know, these patterns yeah. replicate. And there was a dignity and a decorum to the process mm-hmm. in the Senate, and Vic was perfect for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the House was a whole lot more Nelly bar the door.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
go for it.
Yeah. Funny,
kind
we're
of startling.
To Wally Carson,
mm-hmm.
who was part of the leadership in the House, and then was one of the super minority in the Senate.
Right.
And he said...
Yeah, see, Wally, what an elegant guy, too.
Exactly. He's wonderful.
Uh-huh.
But he said that, actually, party discipline was the same in both, because they had such a big majority in the House, you didn't really have to hold people to votes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Senate, they had so few people, it didn't matter at all. So, you know, his
That's
job
wonderful.
Was actually pretty easy on both sides.
That is wonderful. That is wonderful. Very funny. Very funny.
So is this the Bob Davis who then becomes McCall's Bob
yes.
Davis and
yes.
ends up being the Rajneeshi Bob Davis?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes a crucial player because when he dies,
mm-hmm.
Sheila and the mayor... of Rajneesh Puram come
mm-hmm.
over for the memorial service.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody from the governor's office goes.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a secret meeting that is planned that doesn't quite take place, but takes place like a day later. And it's Bob Davis's death
mm-hmm.
that helps me to figure out when that happened.
Really?
Yeah. Jerry actually met with Sheila in a very brief meeting because Sheila shot her mouth off and Jerry said, meeting's over.
Jerry.
Jerry Thompson.
Oh, okay, I'm having lunch with her next week.
Yeah. So
fascinating. Yeah, Bob, oh, that's a whole other, I mean, he's also just quite a character.
Mm-hmm. So you worked in McCall's office?
Mm-hmm. Right the last year or 18 months
okay.
that he was in office, because Bob was there as his chief of staff,
right.
and I had come
right.
back from D.C.
Okay.
And he needed somebody... McCall was in deep trouble with his liberal constituency because
right.
he vetoed a lot of reform legislation.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to get it rewritten and then referred.
Right.
And so I was the staff
yeah.
for the committee that did that.
Yeah.
And and that was because I knew Bob and I come back in town and nobody cared about Capitol Hill experience.
Exactly. Which is pretty funny the way that works.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Amadeo is another one because
mm-hmm.
she was working for Bob Duncan.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And to this day, is not quite sure exactly how she got the job. And other people who work with her are not quite clear how she got the job.
What, with Bob?
No, with Vic.
With Vic, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always thought, how did that happen?
I mean, the recommenders, it was Bob Duncan, who was close with Vic.
Yeah.
They were really close.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Goldschmidt?
Mm-hmm.
Was in fact, Neil Goldschmidt is the one who called her and said, I think you're going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, it's how did she, it just didn't make sense, but she was there with Vic the whole time.
Yeah.
So, kind of wild. But people have described McCall's governorship with people like Bob Davis, but Ed Westerdahl and Ron Schmidt, as McCall, who you know has this amazing connection with people as a state still, but didn't really understand the legislature or the fact that as governor, he just didn't get to make decisions. And so he would talk, and then he'd leave the room, and Bob Davis and Ed Westerdahl and Ron Schmidt, whoever was there, would say, okay, here's how this is going to work.
Yes, exactly. I had an issue one time where, I do remember this, Common Cause got themselves just furious at Ed McCall, and Davis was out of town, and I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to just turn into a public relations nightmare. I don't know what to do. So without Bob there, I just got to go tell the governor because he could get a call in 2 seconds and I know. So I go and talk to him and he is on the ceiling. I didn't know how to peel him off, you know. And I thought I've made this worse because now if anybody calls, he's just so rip-roaring angry. So I went to Bob, you know, a day or two later when Bob was back and I said, we may be paying for this for years. I don't know what to do, and here's what I did. And he said, don't ever go in there alone. I don't care if it's burning down. You will always come to me. And because it just is just as you're describing it.
Yeah.
Tom could relate. He had vision. He wasn't afraid of anything, but not a manager.
Not a manager at all. And that's to that and the personality is why that thing that I sent you last summer, what I've written about Vic and Tom.
Yeah.
You know, Vic just said, that's just Tom being Tom. Because he would do that, boom, and then, you know, 2 days later, write the most gracious note you've ever seen. And it's like, that's just Tom being Tom.
I don't know how he could have felt that way. It was traumatic. McCall never thought he was going to lose.
Right.
And numbers, we didn't have much money in that campaign.
Yeah.
We had...
Roger outraised both of you by a ton.
And he couldn't get any traction.
You know.
And Tom, we raised, the number is 90,000 is what I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it ended up being a little bit more. But by this time, McCall's old guard were leery.
Yeah. So how did he, when did you become involved with the campaign?
Early, before he declared.
Okay.
Yeah, he called me.
So was it a sure thing that he was going to run at that point? Was he when just kind of playing with it before he officially declared? Which is kind of early February that he declared.
Because it was in February that I was talking to him and went to a meeting up at his house. I think when he thought he had some staff, he was ready to go.
Okay.
Now, I can't guarantee that because I was a newbie. I was very young. There was this old guard around him who was advising him not to run.
Right.
And... then you had eager young people like me and the rest of our staff, which was an amazing staff. Phil Kiesling was you know, Robert Frisbee, Melinda Eaton, Don Jarvie, who did the odd even license plates. It was a hell of a staff, I got to say. But the old guard wasn't there, and he needed the old guard for... stability and for people that could talk directly to him and and call him on stuff.
Yeah.
We couldn't.
Yeah. Brent Walt has described it as basically the old guard had gone on with their lives and didn't really want to leave things.
Well, that's part of it. I think that they saw a level of... No one's ever said this to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked. I asked Bob in particular before I did this. How come you guys aren't there?
Yeah.
And they, you know, well, I've got a business and I've got a blah, blah, yeah. But I think they saw that he was not emotionally up to it. And his son was a mess at this point.
Yeah.
And that drained Audrey and Tom unbelievably. And Sam was messing around on the edges all through that campaign.
Yeah.
You know, including calling me and trying to manipulate me into finding Gail. And it was...
Yeah.
So I think having had a family member who was not that bad, but understand how utterly consuming and anxiety-ridden a situation like that can be.
Yeah.
If it's your child, I can't even fathom. So they had that.
Yeah.
They had that. And and I think they were not financially very well off.
No, it's amazing. Money was always a big issue for him.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike Mark Hatfield, he didn't have a John Dellenbach to bail him out.
How did John Dellenbach...
John and Mary Jane would give Mark like $40,000 loans that were forgiven.
Where did John get all his
money? I have no idea. I know the Dellenbachs well. Mm-hmm. I wear bow ties because John Dellenbach is my hero. We went to the same church.
You want a cute story?
So,
this is going to the Medford roots, where Angus grew up on that block and then right around the corner, where the Duncans, the Reddins, Cliff Ouellette, who ran their campaigns, and I think Dellenbach might have been a little bit further up the hill.
That's great. It's great. My dad was the county commissioner in the mid-70s, Republican. Served with two women Democrats. And that he was defeated after one term because he was a pro-choice Republican. And that was 78, the Reagan stuff is beginning to come in.
Things were changing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But all of them lived within the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You can throw a rock and hit, they're all there.
Yeah, they're all there. Yeah, yeah.
That's just the east side of Medford.
Yeah,
it is.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Up.
Exactly. Anyways, I always thought it was Jerry Frank.
It could have been. It very easily could have been.
Did I?
But his name is not one that's ever popped up, whereas the Dellenbachs definitely did.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that. I remained very close to Senator, and he ended up recruiting Angus too, and was chairman of Angus's board for something called the Bonneville Environmental Foundation.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful story that I'll never write, but it's all there in my brain, about how these two political rivals ended up being almost best friends at the end of their lives, and they died in the same room.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite a story. But they had a great deal of respect for one another.
Yeah.
Intellectually, you know, politically, they were kind of problem solvers and...
That's fascinating. I think you ought to write that down at some point just so it's around and buried in an archive. Because one of the things that comes out of this is Ted Kulongoski and Vicatia.
Okay, so what's that?
They became like each other's closest friends.
Yeah.
And as Vic put it, I could go camping with Ted. And it's because it was in the middle of Ted's term as governor. When he picked up the phone, because he was, by God, going to solve the workers' comp stuff.
Yeah.
And he was working things through, and he picked up the phone and said, Vic, because Vic had been through that problem.
Yeah.
And they talked, and Vic said, you're doing the right thing, keep pushing. And that broke the ice. And then when they became ex-governors together, it was Barbara, Vic, and Ted. You know, John was never part of that group. Neil was certainly never part of that group. But they... they became best buds.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, these are charming, yeah. charming stories that yeah. happen in a small environment that we have.
He asked you to manage his campaign. Mm-hmm. How much power did that have? Was it? Did you anticipate it was going to be a tough race?
No.
Anything along those lines? I mean, sometimes managers are basically just doing what the consultant says.
And we didn't
sometimes,
have a consultant.
Okay,
let's
there
start
you go.
There.
Okay.
So I wrote the campaign plan. And I have to say, Ted Halleck told me it was the best campaign plan he'd ever read.
That's good.
Yay. but this was still, we had to have a campaign, kind of more of a McGovern-esque campaign,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
we didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
And it was hard even to have a McGovern-esque campaign, because it was statewide,
right.
and without resources.
It's hard to get to Bruce.
So
yeah.
what we knew we had to do is, the attribute we had was the candidate, and we had to have as much exposure as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant putting him out around the state, having him seen,
mm-hmm.
getting copy off of that. I think we finally were able to cobble together enough money for a poll right at the end, and it showed that this was neck and neck.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the staff certainly never believed
right.
that anybody. We knew that Roger Martin couldn't do it,
right.
Despite his money, and we were stunned at that.
Mm-hmm.
We had no appreciation for the change in the electorate, during the Straub years.
Yeah.
And it really changed. You may have better insight than I do about what were the forces that moved that. Was it just that Tom McCall was such an electric personality? Was it that Mark Hatfield was in D.C. and so that more liberal?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And
mm-hmm.
Clay Myers was still there.
Yeah.
Well, sometime in the mid-70s, those crazy R's took over the Republican Central
Committee. Yeah, the
Husses. The Husses, thank
yes.
you, Walter Huss. So,
and then he kind of gets booted and his wife takes over, so it's like, yay!
Well, we had a meeting.
Yeah.
Clay organized a meeting at his house
mm-hmm.
with the moderates. Remember,
mm-hmm.
Lou Hampton was there, moderate legislators. And worker bees
mm-hmm.
To form a party in exile. And
yeah.
and so, again, I don't know where I have some of those files because I was the executive secretary or something for it. But we got the money to don't give it to the party. Send it here, and then we will distribute it.
Yeah.
And I remember going over to Clackamas County. I lived in like Oswego then. I was a precinct person. And going over to a Republican Central Committee meeting where the Husses had buses
mm-hmm.
that were shipping in people from
mm-hmm.
the haulers of Clackamas County,
mm-hmm.
and they won that.
Yeah.
They won that, Clackamas County.
They were organized in a way that just
stunned
people.
And the first thing they did, they won the vote, and you're just stunned, and they said, and now let us pray. I just remember being frozen, that it wasn't a let me swear in someone,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a thank you for a strong
mm-hmm.
race, or now let us pray. And I thought, I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you walk out in the middle of a prayer? That's
mm-hmm.
really uncouth.
Mm-hmm.
If I stand here in this prayer, it looks like I'm endorsing them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's a sidebar, but it's going back to just this change in the electorate. Why Tom's electability was not there, I just don't know. What I do know is that Vic's earnestness,
mm-hmm.
his stability, his understanding of a business perspective
yeah.
about what was going on, came through it came through.
Yeah.
And I don't know that people didn't think that we'd kind of done the things we needed to do environmentally.
Right, right.
Okay, we got that done.
Yeah.
We've still got forever. We don't have enough revenue in this state. We don't have this. Exactly. We don't have that. I will never really understand what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We dismantled that McCall office really fast.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a dime.
Yeah.
And Tom went off and nursed his wounds for a long time. But the night of the election, I went with him to that. Well, I'm going to go talk to Vic, and I thought, well, he's stunned, he's hurt, he's angry.
Right.
But he'll rise to the occasion. It never occurred to me that he wouldn't.
Right.
Never right. occurred to me.
And I don't know if it was in the thing that I sent you, but Vic is talking to Mark Hatfield that night, saying, "What do I do?"
No.
Because Roger Martin has come to his headquarters and said, "I'm with you." And, you know, the victor doesn't go to the loser. And the loser wasn't going to call. What do I do? And so Vic, much to Denny Miles' dismay, just packed up and walked on over.
It was... Yeah, and it was just sort of McCall at his most... Well, you know, anybody with that kind of a personality, such a dynamic, ego-centered, mm-hmm. I think all politicians are ego-centered, but this mm-hmm. this is a dynamic stage presence.
Yeah.
He has a stage presence.
Yeah.
And he had to work his way through it, and I don't think his wife helped a lot.
Yeah.
I think she kind of aided and abetted some of his worst. Mm-hmm. I watched her needle.
Yeah.
Just when we'd have private meetings about where we were on the campaign and what the schedule was.
Can you imagine having Audrey and his mother?
No, I can't. Anyway, it was traumatic. It was humiliating for the staff to have watched that.
Yeah. So there's Vic walks in. You're down in the lobby or wherever you are.
There's some room. Yeah. Some
and television cameras are on, and McCall lays into.
Mm-hmm,
a
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you go upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about what goes on upstairs. Just a continuation. Vic describes the head of the Republican Party as being in tears.
Mm-hmm. Who was it?
Is it Young? Is that it? I can't see 78 election.
Yes, he was. You're correct. Yeah. Thank you. I knew you'd remind me of things. No, I think we just, no one knew what to say.
Yeah.
So there was not a, personality in the room that had the clout and the stature to correct anything.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm 28 years old, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
And competent, competent mechanically, and understanding what needs to happen, but without a history with this man.
Yeah.
And none of the other staff had history with this man.
Yeah.
And he was wounded. He was a bull elephant, wounded,
mm-hmm.
And raging. And we left, ultimately.
Yeah.
We left. We were unnerved. We also had people in a ballroom.
Yeah.
And we had to shut that down. I mean, we had work.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Was his drinking driving part of this, or was it just Tom's thin skin? Roger Martin describes Vic as going and running into a drunk.
I think here's what I would tell you. I didn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have thought that night. Reflection over the years,
mm-hmm.
I think, but I don't, it's hard to say this,
right.
I have no first-hand evidence, but I do think that there was, yeah, mm-hmm. yes, I do. I think that as I put pieces together, mm-hmm. not that I observed,
right.
but putting pieces together and developing a level of sophistication about alcohol and its mm-hmm. impact and more and more knowledge about Tom, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's also where the old guard, who would have been very familiar, you know, the Roger Martins of the world had been drinking with him for years.
Yeah.
The stories they have about going off on junkets are amazing.
Yeah.
So they would have that
they
history.
They could read that.
Yeah.
We couldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
We couldn't. But I believe that that was one of the reasons that the old guard wasn't there for him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I believe. Again, no one would be frank.
Right.
And that, I believe, was not helpful.
Yeah.
It really wasn't helpful. I think that they thought by not being there for him, that was signal enough in that he wouldn't want to move forward without right. them. But he did.
Yeah. Did you get a sense that he tried to get them to come in? And
oh, my God, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. They turned him down.
So they turned him down.
They turned him down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ron Schmidt did. Mm-hmm. Westerdahl did. Davis did. I think LB did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who else, but... yes.
Yeah.
They said no.
Yeah.
And I'm sure working for him, the nature of their relationships was exceedingly demanding, and it was,
yeah.
you know, it was a 24/7, not a
right.
9-to-5
right.
job, and they all knew that. You know, they're in their 50s now, and they think, you know,
yeah.
been there, done that. I'm sure that's part of it, but I also think that, you know, he has more than a handful to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think men have quite the tolerance for that sometimes that women do.
Yeah, no.
I really, you know, I don't need to do this anymore.
Yeah. I think you're right. It just looking, you know, as you said, Vic is a much different person.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing I asked both Denny Miles and Jerry Thompson was, mm-hmm. tell me about Vic angry.
Oh, and what did they say?
They had great stories. In fact, one of the best is with Ron Schmidt.
Uh-huh.
82 campaign... He is basically, he's not running, but he's one of the main people with the 82 primary.
Yeah.
And they come through the primary, and then he's got this great idea that's going to win Vic in the middle of this horrible recession.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to win the votes, and it's basically we're going to lay off 10% of the state workers, and we're going to freeze everybody's salary. And Vic protected state workers like nobody's business. And Jerry describes it as Vic's eyes getting totally black. And he stands up in the conference room in the governor's suite, and he slams his hand down and says, "You will not bring any more pink elephants to me." And he stomps out of the room. And that was the end of Ron Schmidt having a major role
mm-hmm.
in anything that Vic did.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly, you know...
Oh, he was always around.
Always
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
But it's just... And there's a couple of other ones as well. But it's like, oh, okay, so he did have a temper. Because from his family,
mm-hmm.
I heard about temper things.
Uh-huh.
Or him freezing people out for like 2 years.
I could see that.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he could do it.
But
he could, not by yelling and saying, don't darken my door.
No. People who were around him every day in the Capitol building, but not that close to
mm-hmm.
him. So reporters,
yeah.
people who were not in the inner part of the staff. So I could tell when he was angry because his mouth would slightly change shape.
I think that's true. Yeah, yeah, that's darling. But, yeah, he was always in control, and he didn't show his hand.
No, he didn't. The importance to Vic's side, who also didn't have any money,
mm-hmm. right.
Learned, which is funny because growing up in Southern Oregon, I knew this as a high school student, but they learned that the Oregonian came out the day before and you could wait outside the Oregonian and pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So that famous May poll comes
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
Did that move you guys? There's people who describe that. I mean, Vic clearly looked at it and said, I'm going to win.
Because mm-hmm.
things were changing.
Wait, it scared us.
Yeah, so it's scared. Yeah.
Scared us. And we got some money at that point from some people, but not enough. I don't think we could have bought our way out of it anyway.
Yeah.
I really don't. If we could have done more advertising at that point, that, you know, mm-hmm. this was 19, whatever it was, 78. We bought some TV time and we threw together some advertising. Mm-hmm. But we didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I just put it that way. We just didn't understand it. We did know that we didn't have the conservative areas.
Right.
We knew that.
Right.
But obviously, you can always trump that with Multnomah County.
Yeah, exactly. But there's, this just ticks me off. Republicans will not come to Multnomah County, which has the third largest number of Republicans in the state. It just stuns me. They're Democrats. It's a big county. There are a lot of Republicans there, people. But in this, one of the dynamics that happens is the timber companies are holding their money back. Vic is a natural constituent
mm-hmm,
for that.
Absolutely.
He's not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're holding fundraisers for Straub
mm-hmm.
on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing that because if McCall's the nominee and they all think he is, they just don't
exactly.
want that to happen.
Exactly. Yeah, you're reminding me a lot of this. Right. We weren't going to get money from those guys.
Yeah.
We weren't going to get money from big business generally.
Yeah.
Because of the environmental things. But
mm-hmm.
We also believed it didn't matter. Well, of course it mattered.
Yeah.
But that it wasn't.
We had a celebrity.
Yeah, we had a celebrity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had a celebrity, and nothing was going to beat him. He was a legend. And that was our naivete. I mean, our naivete as a young staff. What we could have done about it.
That's tough.
So what? You know?
Yeah.
we couldn't raise the money.
Yeah.
And we had a pretty good, group of folks that were raising money for us.
Mm-hmm.
They were not able to pop it out.
Yeah.
I think Ted Gamble threw in 10 grand at the end to allow us to do the TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but that poll was scary, and we didn't have the resources, nor did we even have in those days the analytical capacity to delve through and peel it back the way
right.
we could today.
Right, exactly.
And that's the kind of stuff I loved. So
yeah,
it wasn't there to be done.
Did you have organizations around the state?
Not to speak of. We tried. We had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there'd be a person in Josephine County says I'm the guy. Or whatever.
But again, we only had a staff of 5 people. You couldn't build a field organization. And we started in February or March.
Right.
There wasn't enough time. So when we traveled, you'd create a welcome committee or something.
Yeah.
But we didn't have enough money to sustain anybody in
mm-hmm.
Crook County,
mm-hmm.
for example, or
mm-hmm.
couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what Vic was doing. Who was running Vic's campaign?
Carol Whitney, who was just picked out of the blue. I mean, she was a divorcee who'd been running a business as a decorator.
Yeah.
Stanford political science major. And walked in because somebody said, oh, Vic's not hiring right now, but maybe he'll hire you for the campaign. And then when he loses that, he's going to be the leader of the Republicans. And so maybe he'll have a job for you. And they hired her as the manager. So she walked in and somebody said, so what's the campaign plan? And she had no idea in the world what they were talking about.
What's the campaign plan?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Remind, now also just keep in mind that this is, I've been fascinated in the, you know, 40, 50 years mm-hmm. of my career. When I got started, it was so unsophisticated.
Yeah.
All you had to be was smart.
Yeah.
And have a gut for what yeah. this stuff is. And you could do it.
Yeah.
And we didn't have all the, you know, all the capacity to analyze our demographics right. And on and on and on. That we do, well, we did. We had some of it. The way I met my husband was on his dad's campaign
uh-huh.
up here in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And Angus called and he needed staff and he was going to pay me a ridiculous $50 a month or week or something. Mm-hmm. Bring colored thumbtacks. Okay. I've never met you. We've got to get into this room at the crappy old Heathman before it'd been fixed up. Mm-hmm. Where, what's his name? John Haviland would give Democrats free space. And we had the 3rd District, Angus had put it, all the precinct maps, the mm-hmm. 3rd District, all around the 3, mm-hmm. blown up. And we took thumbtacks. And green thumbtacks were put in every precinct that Bob had won in his last campaign. Blue thumbtacks were every precinct with a Democratic registration margin. Mm-hmm. Red thumbtacks went into every, well, who knows, you yeah. know. Yeah. But we had 4 different things and we could eyeball.
Yeah.
We eyeballed our, what we did is eyeballed our persuadable precincts.
Exactly.
And we could see it, but we did this by hand.
Yeah.
And we did it off the most old,
yeah.
Old results. Precinct by precinct.
Yeah.
We won, too, but it was, you just didn't have those capacities then, yeah. so.
It's amazing.
I don't, you know, anyway, so that is what it is. So I don't know what more I can tell you. You'd have to provoke.
Certainly. Did me. You know of the meeting between Vic and Roger where the Republican leadership, Jack Faust was at that, was one of the people, tried to decide between the two of them who should go against Tom McCullough.
Yes, yes. That was...
It's early March.
That was known.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the I mean, it's... He was the former Secretary of State under Hatfield. Howard? Got his name here.
Oh.
It's like not Applegate, but it's something. Appling.
Howell
Appling.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of them too. But they just don't want McCall. So did you heard about that after the fact?
Yeah, it was out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
It was out pretty quickly. And we were waiting to say, we obviously wanted them both to run.
Mm-hmm. Split vote. Yeah. You betcha.
And we're a little nervous if,
yeah.
if we were down to it, it was just going to make it much harder.
Right, right. There were 3 debates.
Yes.
First debate, they all kind of did well, or not well. I think debates are kind of silly, unless you ask good questions. It's one reason why I'm not in the media, because I've done a couple of debates, and they don't let me ever do them again, because I ask them questions they would never have thought of. And it's really, really fun because I'm an academic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an analyst. I'm not. I don't want to ask you the same thing that's been in the news all the time. We know what you're going to say.
Oh, you mean you wanted real information?
Yeah, exactly. My favorite was several years ago doing the for people running for the head of Metro, and I just peppered him with stuff about the zoo.
About the what?
The zoo. You run this thing. Yeah, we know all the land use stuff. That's well known. Great. Tell me about zoo and tell me about garbage collection. Because garbage collection is what actually makes a difference. Let's go. And, like, 2 of them had no clue in the world.
The zoo runs it. You know what? I ran a campaign for Metro exec when years ago mm-hmm. in the 80s when Rick Gustafson was running for mm-hmm. his second term. And the what we did is we used the zoo because Metro was still highly controversial.
Oh, yeah.
So new. And then anytime you tried to do with land use and it was so much. Says, well, what's the feel good out of this?
Patty.
Stupid zoo.
Patty in the zoo. Just absolutely.
And Rick is just vomiting over this. Exactly. And I'm saying, I don't know what else to do. I don't have a clueless.
So 78, there's these debates.
Yeah.
And in the second one down in Eugene.
Yeah.
That's where Roger stands up and basically says, we don't need another king. And Tom flies off. What kind of debate prep did you do at all?
We did some, and it was largely, it was probably Phil Kiesling and Robert Frisbee who did that, because they were the issues guy and the speechwriter. And Halleck. Halleck was a Democrat.
Yeah.
And flamboyant as well.
Yes.
And loved this stuff. So he and a PR guy.
Yeah.
So that's where the debate prep took place. And I cannot recall how intense it was. We had great confidence that it didn't matter what was thrown at McCall, he was better on his feet, and he was more colorful than either of those candidates.
Exactly.
And we just thought his very presence would dominate. Now again, this is arrogance,
right?
On our part. The other thing was, he knew the issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that you had, but each, all three of those guys knew the issues.
Yeah.
So debate prep, we had originally thought of as, we needed to update Tom on where the issue was now. And so we had to have research, we had to do the backgrounding.
Mm-hmm.
But debate prep the way it's done today, about how you're going to present yourself and where you're standing, and we didn't, that wasn't, I mean, he was a TV guy. I mean, he knew how to use the camera. He knew how to use the stage.
Right.
He could prep us, you know.
Yeah.
So, what we were surprised about was how good the other guys were.
Mm-hmm.
That was the surprise.
Mm-hmm. And Roger was more seat of the pants.
Oh, yeah.
But Vic, it's because, and I would love to explore this in more depth, but I have other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think Denny's kind of the first modern PR person to be at that role. Because they were prepping Vic for those debates exactly like they do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly like, because Vic, you know, after Vic won the primary.
Yeah.
The Statesman Journal editorial was great. It was like, well, whoever wins between Straub and Atiyah, we know they're not going to be a scintillating speaker.
Yes.
We've listened to both of them, and paint drying is more exciting.
You know, and this is, I would have to say, one of the things that pushed McCall into the campaign is what a drag Straub was.
Oh, yeah.
Good man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good man. But just a friggin' drag.
Yeah.
And made McCall crazy.
Yeah. We've had a symbolic governor. It's just good political science. Head of government, head of state. So McCall was a great head of state. He was the Queen of England.
Yeah.
He was a pretty lousy head of government, but he had staff that were great.
Oh, he had. Oh, my.
And then Straub turns out not to be good at either of them.
But he was a noble sort of man.
Exactly. He was
noble.
You know,
quietly.
Yeah.
Noble, although not an innocent.
Oh, certainly not an innocent.
Yeah. My father-in-law had some kind of negative stories about Straub, and I can't, I really can't remember what they were, you know, anymore.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, I'd always thought, I was, and Bob said, well, no, wait a minute, you know, he pulled this and that in the campaign, and he did da da da, you know.
Yeah.
So,
same thing with
but that is, that did, you provoke in me this memory that McCall could could not abide Straub. And McCall felt that everything he'd done would slip away because of the lackluster personality in the governorship.
Yeah, it's a personality to push.
It was a personality.
And you can see the Willamette Greenway never came together because it wasn't, there was any champion.
And I think he was inherently impatient with a personality like Vic's. I know that he had regard for Vic's capacity. No doubt. And he'd had to deal with Vic in the legislature, and Vic delivered what he said he'd deliver, and when he said there was a problem, there was a problem, all of that. But there was nothing exciting about Vic that that turned Tom on. And Tom not only had an exuberance, he needed it from other people.
Exactly.
So you weren't going to get that from Vicatilla.
Yeah.
So that was also, and that was one of the things, how the hell could such a self-contained guy beat me?
Yeah, who's this gray person? Beat me in living color.
Yeah. How the hell did that happen?
Exactly.
You know, so.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And if Vic understood that intellectually, I think Vic had every right to be furious. He had every right to be hurt. But I would say, in the end, the staff, my staff, and me, were relieved about the outcome. Very relieved. And that's hard to say, but in the middle of this, someplace in the middle of this, I was ready to quit because he was not manageable.
Right.
I could manage the functions, but the candidate was not manageable, and we all recognized that.
Yeah.
And so we kept him out where he did well, where he did got the approbation, and but he was not manageable, and I felt like if I left, that would further that would erode.
Right.
That would not be good,
right,
even if I wasn't the best person, the right person.
Right.
Having your campaign manager leave late in the campaign is bad news.
Yeah.
So I didn't. But, you know, there was never a... He was bitter. He was very bitter.
Yeah.
And so he would blame us.
That's what staff are for.
That's the way it was. And then I was not around for the fall campaign, so I...
I was... There's a parallel to that in the fall campaign. Because by then, all the timber money comes their way, so they have... You're talking about not having money?
Uh-huh.
At one point, they knew they had to run ads. They had no money at all. And a mystery $5,000 check came in the mail that day.
And they did they ever find out who?
It was somebody who... Because Vic would go to these places and he'd talk to people... And this guy he'd never met before said, I really like you.
Oh, my God.
And then they contacted him and said, thank you. He said, do you need more? I said, certainly. And they were able to run ads.
Yeah.
But in the fall campaign, Greg Walden has come on. Roger Martin said to Carol Whitney, what can I do for you? And she said, give me Greg Walden. Because Walden had been
within
Roger Martin's campaign.
He
was a staffer or an intern.
He wasn't the manager.
But he was one of the young men who were as part of that came on.
I'm writing him nasty emails these days.
He won't. I've approached him several times and he won't talk to me for the book either.
He won't?
No. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. It's your choice.
Really?
But he gets caught up in something. He delivers a fake news thing to a writer for the Oregon Journal. And Vic is driving along in his car and hears this fake news thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he hits the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to fire Carol. He wants to fire Greg. He wants to fire Denny.
Mm-hmm.
They talk him down. But the main argument is you can't fire your campaign manager because that shows
Yeah, that
the
shows.
Uncertainty.
Yeah,
that's the message you don't want to send.
Exactly.
So I don't know if you know any of this. I certainly never heard of it. Vic first meets Tom McCall in 1958 because Vic goes to a candidate night at Raleigh Hills School, where his wife is the head of the PTA, and Tom McCall is the moderator. Vic wins, and Tom McCall occasionally comes over to dinner
at their
house in the early 60s. And Tom, Atiyah, vividly remembers it because Tom's son would come pick him up. And they were really worried that he wouldn't get home. But they're all not buddy buddy, but there's clearly a conversation going on here. But in 64, all of a sudden the Secretary of State position opens up. And as it's looking like it's going to open up, there are seven or eight people mentioned as possible, and McCall is one, Clay Myers is one, Vic Atiyah is one. And when it happens, Vic is quite happy he's not going to do anything. That's where McCall goes in, and Clay Myers is basically his campaign guy.
And
he goes on
to
fame, fame and fortune. So there's this longer history between them than just the legislature and the colorful guy. So it's just fascinating to see that and pick it up.
But it's this state. I mean, you pick apart anything.
And they both looked just kind of right over one side of the hill and the other side of the hill. Right up here.
Oh, I know it. It's all... It all weaves itself together. We're just too small. too damn small.
I've even begun to encounter that. There was a Statesman Journal article. The city of Salem was doing something in a campaign, and he asked me about it, and I said, looks like they crossed the line in their campaign. And... who was the spokesman for the city of Salem? One of my former students. It's like, okay, there you go.
Exactly. It is the way it is, and I just always have thought this Medford Street is the perfect example.
Yeah.
You know, all these guys.
Exactly.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
And it's still.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah.
Probably less so up here, but you know.
Well, no, it still is. It's stunning. For instance, because I do international stuff, students who want to stay in the area, international, it's like great. So if you want to be corporate, which case Nike would be a great place for you. If you want to save the world, Mercy Corps. Mercy Corps is a Peace Corps mafia. You can't.
It's hard to get in.
You can't break in.
You can't.
Yeah, it's tough. And you know, then there's just so many things like that. It's like, sorry, you may be the most well-qualified person in the world, but guess what? Silly connections.
Yeah, no, I can remember when Goldschmidt went to Nike, and this was shortly after I had gotten my master's. He said, "Well, Neil, you're running international Nike, and what can you do?" Well, it was the recession. It was life was crap. And he apologized. But yeah, that was or the port.
Yeah,
you could go to the port.
Yeah,
but really, the port. I've learned much more about it. There's so much technical stuff versus the.
It's technical and real estate. That's the port. Right about the same time, because there was the who was it? I think Mike Thorne left. And they were bringing in Bill Wyatt.
Oh, when they brought in Bill.
Yeah.
Did Bill follow Mike?
I'm not sure. There might be somebody in between.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I said, because that's when I was leaving the University of Portland, I said, you know, what the heck? I do international economics. And so I wrote this thing up and I sent it in and said, you know, you're stuck in the 19th century here. Let's not be in the 19th century. Here's my idea. And of course, nothing happened. Because it's, you know, whatever Kitzhaber wanted. But finding out how small our port is, how insignificant it is, how it could play a different role, but it's stuck in basically technical stuff and real estate. It's like you're going to be a connection to the world.
You have a fundamental issue though, and that's we've got a river that's not going to handle any of the large ships.
Right. Yeah.
So you're going to get what you're going to get, and if the containers aren't going to come in,
yeah, maybe this will get Tongue Point actually going in Astoria.
I have no idea. I was on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots until the last couple of years, and boy, did I learn a lot about the economic drivers here and in the shipping industry, and where we were competitive and where we would. We had lost competitiveness.
Right.
And it was impossible to regain it because technology and many things have just gone beyond us, and we're an awkward port.
We're an awkward port. And what we have to offer the world is things like hay and potash.
Wheat.
Yeah. What the world has to offer us is, if you're convenient, we can transship.
Exactly.
And it's like, that's not going to make you the same.
And I did a series of reports, papers, when I was getting my master's on the wheat trade out of Oregon.
Yeah.
So this is in 79, 80. And, you know, what did it look like in China? What did it look like in Japan? It was fascinating.
I had no idea that it was Oregon wheat that started the raw mat craze.
Yeah.
I have no clue in the world. It's like, that is so cool. Why don't we know that?
There's a lot we don't know. That whole community, that wheat, the guys here, the wheat companies, live in their own world. And they... I like them a lot, but they don't play with the rest of the community. They know what they're doing.
Right.
They're shipping this commodity. They're going to ship this commodity. They don't net particularly fraternize with the larger shipping community. Mm-hmm. They don't need them. Mm-hmm. They have as sophisticated, if not more sophisticated, economic analysis about what's happening in the world, wheat, and where they're going. They don't need the port to tell them. They don't need our Department of Economic Development or whatever it's called now to tell them.
Yeah. Big thing when Vic was in, they opened up an Oregon office in Tokyo.
Yes.
Fantastic.
I remember.
Excellent. 1984. Boy, we hit the big time. The wheat growers had had one there since 1959.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, that's where you get into the what can government do versus what can private business do better,
right,
faster, more efficiently.
Yeah.
Oh, so.
When our office went in there, because we're coming out of the recession, money is really tight.
Mm-hmm.
We got a great deal on the office because Japanese bank was financing the PacWest Center. And because of that, things were forgiven.
So whose office?
Our Oregon office in Tokyo.
Oh, in Tokyo.
Was able to basically meet our budget.
Uh-huh.
Because since they were financing the PacWest Center. So, hands are shaking here. Money happens there.
This is my guy who built the PacWest Center. We just went on a big trip with. We just got back a couple of weeks ago, John Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so young when he did this. He was 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wondering whether he was going to be in debtor's prison.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
To get it all done. And he did it.
Yeah.
He did it. It was phenomenal. And boy, was it gutsy. He had a brand new baby, two stepkids.
Yeah.
As he said, he was betting a farm.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's crazy.
Anyway, I don't know.
No, this is great. This is wonderful.
Well,
if anything, jumps out at you, just send me an email.
Mm-hmm,
you
know, and I will.
This is because I do these, and it's like it shakes things loose.
Yeah, well, when you ask some questions, I wouldn't have a lot of the stuff in the campaign.
Yeah.
I don't have it at my fingertips anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's a 40-year-old campaign at this point.
Yeah. I just don't, and as I said, it ended traumatically. So you want to block that? And I went up to in the fall. So it was what, the spring of 70?
Spring of 78.
Yeah. Yeah. So the fall of 78, I had a fellowship mm-hmm. at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
yeah,
that was pure, as I said, breathing pure oxygen.
Yeah.
Truly spectacular experience. And then I went back and got my master's there. But that was really wonderful because I could look beyond the confines of this state, which can be a little...
It's a little claustrophobic.
Yeah.
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 One of the questions I asked Vic, because he's, you know, he's there. He's not in the center of the beach bill, mm-hmm. but he is in the center of the bottle bill.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the center of all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they make an appearance in the book, because mm-hmm. he's in the middle. And even the beach bill does, because it kind of shows a bipartisanship yeah. we don't see anymore. But I said, you know... did you, as governor, look at other states? It's like the PERS stuff that's going on right now.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, great. You do know that our state is actually better off than virtually every other state. We're doing something right. But there are other states who are better off than us by a lot. Do we look at them? Do we talk about them? Is it part of the policy discussion? No, not at all. So I asked him about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said... No, I didn't do that because we were cutting, you know, breaking so much ground that there was really nobody to compare it to. And it's like, God, you guys, you miss so much by not doing that.
Well, think about the size of the governor's staff when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone when I was working for McCall.
Yeah.
Well, Pat Amadeo was the environmental. You were just moving into policy advisors then.
Right.
You didn't.
But
he had them.
He had two. He had Pat Amadeo
mm-hmm.
for natural resources
mm-hmm.
and environment.
Yeah.
And he had Bob Oliver for everything else.
Yeah, Bob Oliver was McCall's
yeah.
counsel. You know,
McCall's counsel and.
Yeah, yeah. But
yeah.
exactly. That's.
That was it.
Yeah, and then you had Denny as the PR guy,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
As the Ron Schmidt. So, you didn't... I don't know where you would have gone to do that. And you just were creating the Office of Legislative Research in the early 70s.
Right. Bruce Bishop's. Yeah.
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 I think Kerry Jackson was there, too. But at any rate... That was brand new. And
yeah.
I also remember coming from the Hill, not that I was, you know, anything important in the Hatfield staff, and I'd done a campaign for Pete McCloskey, who ran against
yeah.
Nixon. At any rate, coming to Salem and just being, after D.C., coming back to Salem and just being appalled at the basic... Yes.
Yeah.
And then learning how you make that basicness work.
Right.
And you do. And you can be far more effective,
yeah.
much, much faster. But just think,
yeah.
well, we don't have, what's congressional
yeah.
research to do this? And
right. But even that was really new. It's like the Congressional Budget Office is 1973-74.
Right, right.
It's just because they're saying we're tired of getting jerked around by the president.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
yeah,
all
actually,
new then.
Actually, my girlfriend who just left before you were here,
uh-huh.
Who's just moving here, this was yesterday
mm-hmm.
and today, her stuff is right, she went to work at the CBO in that first round
yeah.
of stuff
yeah.
as a defense analyst.
Sounds great.
And then she went on to the NSC. But
yeah.
So, I mean, I watched that
yeah.
too come along, and then following Hatfield on appropriations
yeah.
and, you know, how he learned to use it. And
yeah, but it's fascinating that you had to learn how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fascinating to me. Just
well,
so
but see, you're...
That's in the book.
Yeah, but see, that it is, but that's...
Yeah.
That's why I love political science. It's
yeah.
just, you try to say, that this is really... interesting
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
How do you make this work, and how do you force it into the process? And
right.
I love that stuff. So, not everybody does, but that's what keeps you going.
Exactly. I have one chapter in the book which I can see an editor is going to say, "Really?" But it's just how the governor's office worked.
Oh, But it's mandatory if you're going to understand. Yeah.
It's personalities, there's systems, there's changes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so okay, so you've got your factors.
Yeah. So for instance, Straub was really, really, really open about saying, let's make this transition work.
Mm-hmm.
Something that was exactly the opposite of when Goldschmidt came in. Goldschmidt ignored everything. In fact, the best story about that is the day after Goldschmidt, so Goldschmidt's inaugurated, the next day they come into work, no one has a key to the office.
I think I've heard this story, yeah.
It's from Jill Thorne.
Uh-huh.
And Jill Thorne, because she knew the building, so she got security and they opened the door. No one had any idea how to turn on the lights. They didn't know where the switches were and all those weird panels.
So they had refused transition.
It turns out that Vic had given Neil the key.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Neil didn't see it was part of his issue to make sure that anybody had it so they could get in the office. That wasn't his wheelhouse.
Oh, Jesus, Neil. Something happened. We've always, Angus worked for him as when he was mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is always, we're never very close to him like some of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But I speculated what happened because he was such a collaborative mayor.
Yeah.
And he gave people their lead and they went and they did it and it was bring it back. And somehow when he got to be governor,
And the hypotheses are he caught Washington, D.C.-itis, which I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy named Don Kennedy, who was the president of Stanford, where I went, went back, was the head of the FDA, came back, became the president.
Mm-hmm.
And he was awful.
Really?
He was great. People loved him when he left.
Yeah.
When he came back, he was awful.
Yeah.
Or was it the Nike thing, which you think would give him business expertise and international?
Yeah.
And he never bought into the international. Really.
He didn't really.
He would like to go fly places, but doing the hard work of making it so that, like Vic was doing, so that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, stuff would happen.
And talking to Barbara and Ted, they just say it's just too much work and we have too much to do here.
Mm-hmm.
But
and that's true because it still is pretty hands-on.
It's very hands-on. And by Vic doing that, stuff that Jerry won't let me put in the book.
Uh-huh.
I have some of it, but he was just gone so much.
Vic was.
Yeah, Vic was gone so much. Jerry's running the office. She's running the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even have instantaneous communication unless he got on the phone.
Right. So she's out there stranded.
So she's stranded and hoping, and she it's wonderful for me because she kept daily memos that she wrote to him about what had happened.
Oh, that's.
So I have a gold mine of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But. And Vic was right, if you're going to get business, you have to go and spend a lot of time with these Japanese guys and these Taiwanese people and these Chinese people. And you can't do that anymore. So it's just the world has changed in major ways.
Yeah, isn't that, that's fascinating stuff, I think. And the thing that Neil said about his governorship was that he ended up being a prison governor, and that we built more prisons while he was governor. He said, that's not why
exactly.
I came here. But I want to do this.
Yeah.
Another
hypothesis about him, which I think makes more sense, he knew how to get to 3 votes on the city council. Getting to 31 and 16 is a very different beast.
Very different, and without any.
And he didn't have Tom McCall's staff.
No.
To make that happen.
He had a good staff, though. He did have a good staff, but again, I don't think they were steeped in legislative arcana.
No.
You know where your gut drives you after a while. You know what you know where to dodge and to weave and.
Yeah.
And Neil also, I don't think Neil liked the, what do I want to say? You know, the kissing up, too.
Yeah, yeah. You got to smile when the majority leader or minority leader comes in and have weekly meetings with them and be kind to them and do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Vic, because he was never in the majority,
mm-hmm.
was a master at that.
Yes, and they said that's what I'm saying. You master what you need to master,
exactly.
And it never leaves you, and your brain thinks that way when it comes to, oh, I need to talk to so-and-so, or we need to pull that coalition back together again. That da, da, da. But you know this history, and you know what levers to pull. Neil didn't.
No. One of the things, I interviewed Kate Brown for this book as well. And found some wonderful connections that I had no idea about. But one thing that I hadn't occurred to me, she was in the minority for 17 years.
Yes.
And so I keep waiting. I can see it behind the scenes in the way she governs. She's got to bring that out. She's got to bring that out. Especially, if Bueller puts together any campaign at all. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. He's teetering along. Does he get too shrill and sound more like Trump? Which is going to kill him.
Yeah, it will kill him.
He's got to do more than just say the Democrats are looking corrupt. So we'll see. But she's got to bring that out.
I don't know if she can.
Yeah.
She needs this cap and trade victory.
Yeah, absolutely.
Big time. But she doesn't have a dynamic personality.
No.
You can't make somebody into somebody they're not.
No, exactly.
So she's gotta have a couple of the transportation thing, not necessarily because she did the work, but she could claim it.
Mm-hmm.
Then this thing, she's gotta get it. She's gotta get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Bueller is going to raise a lot of money from Republicans. And I
do too, but he's got to raise a ton of money.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to have more because he sounds sensible.
Mm-hmm.
He's not strident like a far-right guy would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's very conservative. But I think if she doesn't offer a dynamic alternative.
Right. Yeah. Just
watch Washington County. You know, that's all.
I don't think Washington County will go. But Clackamas.
Did you want?
No, I'm fine. Okay. I'm fine. Thanks. Yeah. But yeah, it's amazing. One of the things I did for this project is I put together the gubernatorial results forever.
Yeah, you said this.
It's
the
Snell thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating. Republicans win by a lot. Only exception is John Kitzhaber beating Bill Sizemore in 1998.
Kitzhaber
beating Bill Sizemore, the anti-tax guy.
Oh.
Which is, the Republicans had no candidate, so Bill Sizemore wins in
Kitzhaber. Yeah, right.
In numerical terms, it's the largest victory, and in percentage terms, it's like number three or number four.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
But Republicans win by a lot. Democrats win by a little. So in numerical terms, Kate's victory was like number 8 or number 9 out of 41.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was quite good.
In numerical terms, but in percentage terms, it's in the bottom quarter. Because we had a bigger turnout because it was a special election with a presidential thing.
Yeah.
So it's the Democrats, while they certainly appear to have a lock on things, they don't win by as much as the Republicans used to when this was a Republican state. So it's just the dynamics.
Can you read in these numbers? Have you divided them by county or by area?
I haven't done that, but you can see from what I've looked at, the big thing is watching Multnomah County go from Republican to Democrat, which is a process that's going on and finishes kind of in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
The thing that puts the nail in the coffin is single-member districts.
Yeah.
That does it.
Yeah.
And that's where the Republicans are saying, oh, single-member districts, we're going to do well. And it's like, well, no, you're going to get shut out. And they did.
Yeah.
When it was they had kind of four districts, and two of them were Republican, and two of them were Democratic. There were five. So the Democrats had three of these at-large things,
mm-hmm.
and the Republicans had two.
Mm-hmm.
And so between them, that means you get like 7 Republicans and 12 Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Go to single-member districts, and you get one Republican.
Well, see,
that's the big shift.
So, okay, so are you going to ever do a, you know, a class sort of like on this stuff?
I think I might, because I've got all sorts of ancillary stuff that would be great. I've also talked with, I've been thinking about it for years, but Jeff Mapes, who's at the Urban League, is now at OPC.
Yeah.
I think sitting down, because this is a Republican state, writing a history of the Republican Party here.
Do you know what, that's what I taught at Harvard.
Uh-huh.
I taught it when this fellowship that I had mm-hmm. required you to teach an undergraduate seminar.
Mm-hmm.
What they really wanted you to do is call every national personality you know and have them come give lecture
exactly.
so that they could say so and so was here.
Right.
But of course this was so many years ago. But it was really fascinating to research.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get into. And I did it because of what was happening in this state.
Yeah, the shift. The Husses of the world.
The Husses had come.
The Reagan Revolution, yeah.
We'd just had the property tax limitation in California,
yep.
and we were threatened with it here.
Yep.
And I could see all of this change. And so I wanted to understand sort of nationally. So, you know, I went back to the beginning, and it was a lot of fun. To do, but do you think this is a Republican state with Portland as an outlier?
I think that most, for instance, most of the Portland things now are mainline Republican things from the Hatfield and Duval years. I think John Kitzhaber would make a great moderate Republican in 1965.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Ted Kulongoski. If you leave aside the labor stuff,
mm-hmm.
would make a good modern Republican in 1965. Before that, the Republicans, because of Earl Snell's death
mm-hmm.
and Hatfield mm-hmm. and Travis Cross, you know, they kind of accelerate things. But before then, the Republican Party was strong here, but it was profoundly conservative.
Oh.
But it wasn't racist. Trying to figure out why Vic is a Republican.
Because.
Mm-hmm. Immigrants are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a variety of reasons why his dad became a Republican. I don't know, because I don't really thought to ask him, really. But one of the things is, the Democratic Party was fundamentally racist in the teens and 20s, when he's beginning to say, who am I?
Yeah.
As a politically. So it's not just he's a downtown merchant, and he's probably hanging out with other Republicans.
Yeah.
It's if his alternative is a group that is basically looks like the KKK, why would he do that? And so there's just fascinating currents going through.
This is really fun stuff.
Fascinating currents in there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'd never, you know the KKK history in the state a bit.
Yeah.
And you know there's a lot of racism in the state still, of course. Harder to define. The first black family that moved to Medford.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be in the 60s, I guess. I don't know. But Angus's mom was the sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And she, they all remember, the kids all remember them getting phone calls, nasty,
mm-hmm.
nasty phone calls
mm-hmm.
about how can you, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I grew up in suburban San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know that if you were Asian, that was different.
Yeah.
We didn't know that.
Exactly.
So, we did know being black was different. But we didn't see anything else because it was such an integrated community.
Yeah. That's because I went to Stanford and
that
whole area down there.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. I grew up very near Stanford campus.
We go to Menlo Park all the time. My wife and I just love getting off the airplane in San Jose. It's like...
Isn't it?
Look at that. Yeah. Diversity. What a thing.
I know.
Oh, that's great.
I remember getting to Salem and thinking, oh my God, it's been a whole semester. I haven't seen a single minority face.
Yeah.
And remembering when there was a black person walking through downtown Salem, I still remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think my option was Cal. okay, my education is going to be, many people come to big schools so that they can experience the world. Yeah. I've grown up with it. Mine is going to be to understand what makes the rest of this world. I remember thinking this. This is something you've got to learn.
Yeah.
You've got to appreciate it.
Yeah.
And this is very weird.
Yeah. And it's a bubble that people think they're in. And they don't think about it at all.
Well, they don't. You don't know what you don't see.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, and then I thought, well, and this is, I couldn't have done what I did in the state capitol if I'd gone to Sacramento State, which that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, I tried to appreciate, and then the intimacy as of the political experience here is far different. And as I said, you can be effective in a way that would be hard in California or wherever. Yeah. But yes, I get off. My aunt lives in Palo Alto, and she has a place in Carmel, so we're down there.
Yeah, that's where I went to school, to Monterey Institute. So I lived in Carmel right by the Pine Inn.
But did you?
And we actually go down every January for 3 days.
So you went, my son has got his MBA from the Monterey Institute.
Oh, great. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, and he lived in her basement.
Yeah, but I was caring for an old lady, so it was I lived in Carmel, but there was a real cost.
Yeah. Well, so you got a master's there or a doctorate?
Yeah, master's.
Yeah. And in international...
It's called International Policy Studies.
Yeah. His was in international business.
Yeah.
I just remember him trying...
Shutting down that program.
Huh?
They're shutting down that program.
The international business program?
Because there's now so much competition, and it's hard for the school to differentiate itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then Middlebury took it over. Just while he was there, I think, is when that happened.
Yeah.
I just remember he was cramming French. Just.
Yeah. That's what I tell people. We have seniors in high school who come to Pacific, our unit here. We just finished a round, and you're supposed to get up there as faculty and say, this is kind of where I started. Because they really are interested in your how you came to be an academic. And talking to them about Monterey, you know, you basically had to be intermediate or advanced language, and I was, and I got there and I found it wasn't a language they did.
And which what language?
Italian.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really good in Spanish, but I didn't want to do Spanish. So I learned Arabic. But to prove that I was at this advanced level, not only did I have to talk Italian people and read stuff, and things, but I went over my transcript from Stanford. Where I didn't really know what I wanted to major in. I declared a history major because they wouldn't let me go overseas unless I declared a major, and I just counted up units.
Yeah.
And so I was doing this 3 years later, and I had an Italian major I had no idea I'd completed. Just because I just took classes I like to take. And for the students today who are like, oh, I know exactly what I'm going to be able to do this, it's like, okay, great. I'm your worst nightmare. I had no idea. I didn't even know until 3 years later what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
This worked out just great.
Yeah. Colin went in the Peace Corps, and then he said he figured out that there was no way any third world country was ever going to get by unless they had some understanding of business.
Yeah.
And that that's why he went. Not that he's done anything with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But as he said, he came in with 4 years of Russian, and he'd had French in high school, and he said the level they want you to get at that school, he said there was no way to get there in Russian.
Exactly.
So I had to go back and do it in French because I could learn it faster.
Right. Yeah.
And just sweating bullets.
Yeah. And it's wonderful, but when, you know, doing the international stuff, every once in a while in an intro class and then our provision classes. So how many people want to go do, you know, the international something, nonprofit or whatever? And more than half the class will put their hands up and say, great. So how many of you are in advanced language right now? And every hand will go down.
Yeah.
And I say, well,
you don't get to do it.
So you got to take your language classes. There you go. It isn't just all, I understand how the communist system works.
It doesn't matter.
Talk to them.
Yeah. Or when we met Colin in Moscow, where he was for a term, like over there, he said, do not open, this is right after perestroika, well, when was it?
Uh-huh.
Don't open your mouth, Mom, you're going to get shaken down. Wear your dowdiest clothes so you look like a Russian. Only let me talk. Okay, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Anyway.
Well, this is wonderful. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And I wish that...